Hey everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. Two sponsors, Environments for Humans. Over the course of 2 days, see what's happening next with web building. Join me, Dave, Sarah Soy Dan, Val Head, people you know and love from the show on the legendary Queen Mary docked in Long Beach, California. Check out cssdevconf.com for that. And this episode of Shop Talk is brought to you in part by new sponsor, Braintree. How cool is that? If you're working on a mobile app searching for the right payments API, check out Braintree's version .0 SDK. With one simple integration, your customers get to pay every way to pay. And we'll tell you more about all the every ways to pay and just how cool Braintree is later in the show. For now, let's kick things off.
Hey there, dear listener. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about surfing, because I'm a surfer now. I went surfing, and I'm a surfer in the future.
Can you surf in Austin? Was it a standing paddleboard, really, instead?
Yeah, well, we have those, but we are getting, like, America's first surf park. Did you know these things exist? It's like a giant...
I've seen the ones at malls.
It's like a giant 300-foot wave pool, and they'll like have surfing. So, you know, I surf now. I'm back from vacation, sunburned, and so...
Oh, that's right. So, Dave's back from San Diego, we've transcended space and time here. I forgot.
Yeah, I'm future speaking.
Yeah, this one is we typically don't record this far in advance, but just it's summer, so that's the case. And plus, it doesn't matter, so let's not dwell on it. This is a rapid fire episode.
Bazooka.
That's right, where we try to get through more questions than we typically are able to in a guest episode. You know, once in a while, we'll get to like one or two, which is kind of not the original spirit of Shop Talk Shows, getting to as much Q&A as we possibly can. So let's Mr. Donald Wasserman writes in at least twice a week. Someone other than me will drop in a few lines of SCSS into our project, compile it, and we'll end up in Merge Conflict Town, adding a painful step to our branching process. How would you handle this? To date, my strategy has been to leave the room when anybody looks like they're going to do a merge conflict. So... we've talked about this before, haven't we, Dave? The deal is you compile your SCSS down into .css, and then what you're doing, Donald, is committing to your project the CSS as well. Now, a way some people have handled this in the past is to not even commit your CSS. I see it all the time. It's becoming a very common practice because part of your deployment process will build the CSS. There's really no need for your CSS to be in the repo at all, especially when it's, you know, minified, compressed, comments removed, all that type of thing. It's moved onto one line. The diff of that file will be pretty useless anyway. It really doesn't need to be in your repo. And when it is in your repo, it causes merge conflicts because Git is a little bit less smart about being able to intelligently resolve conflicts when to it looks like the entire file has changed.
Which I think is a feature of Git. It's sort of like, well, I'm out. Like, this is a human issue. Like, two humans worked on this thing. I'm out. I'm not going to auto-negotiate anything.
Notice that you didn't have a merge conflict probably on your SCSS because that's nice and spaced out and line by line, and it probably merged those things just fine. So if that is the case, if your SCSS merged fine with all the other people's work and all you have is a merge conflict in the CSS, just be like, whatever, I was the last person to write in this file. It merged together fine, so I'm going to blow away the CSS and replace it with my compiled CSS, and it's not a merge conflict because I win. Because that will be fine. As long as the SCSS was fine, whoever is the last person to commit, the whatever CSS they compile is legit. Mm-hmm. So, forget, just be like, result, you know, mine wins. Pick that option and tower or whatever. That's how I use it. I don't know how you do it.
That makes sense. Yeah, like so you're talking about a merge tool. Git Tower has one. Kaleidoscope is another cool one for the Mac. I think.
You kind of have choices in a merge conflict. You can mark it as resolved, just be like, I don't know, I went in here and messed with this file in this weird merge state, and I've decided it's okay now. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know if there's actual if these map to actual Git commands or not. But in Tower, it says resolve it with my copy. Or resolve it with their copy, my copy being the branch that you're currently on, theirs being the one that you're merging into. So it's just kind of like I would just probably pick any three of those options and then just make sure I recompile it on my end one more time before I commit it again. It's fine. It's not a true merge conflict. A true merge conflict is when you both altered like the same line of code or around the same area in code, and it was way confused about which line kind of matters the most in there. That's like a real merge conflict that really needs human eyes. This is like a fake merge conflict that you.
And you can do that to yourself, or I did it to myself once. I was working in a branch, you know, trying to be all safe and isolated, and then I had to switch over to master, update some things, and then I had to switch over the branch, and I was ready to merge that in, and then it's like, nope, you've like both worked on page header, and this new page header has a whole bunch of junk in it. So I had to kind of manually stitch together these two versions, and that takes a lot of brain hurt. But it's possible. And it's pretty easy to search through the file. You just look like Git's. At first I was like, I hate Git. It's not elegantly designed. Like, cause it just spits out these like angle brackets and it says head. And you know, it's like pretty gnarly. And I was mad at it for not being graceful, but like really it's, I find that to be, again, another feature because it's like it's ugly, it's messed up, it renders bad. It like it's like, hey, here's a problem. This area right here, I put a little fence around it. You deal with it. So, It's not always easy, but
it's a good point though. It wouldn't hurt to have a little bit of extra context in there instead of angle bracket, head.
Yeah,
like maybe bracket, you could tell bracket, me like something who you committed know. That or what the name of the branch was or. Anyway, enough. Donald, good luck. This is a rapid fire. So
try not to do compiled CSS. Bingo, bango, pew. All right. Whoa, weird. I forgot how weird that was. All right, next. Matthew Greenfield writes in. It's a long one, so I'm going to have to read a lot. Here we go. I have a website with hundreds of raster images around 15 KB each. During interaction with a single page, it's very likely a user will need to see every one of those images. Okay, so a bunch of hundreds of 15 KB images. I have done a bunch of lossless and lossy compression. Now I need to load all these puppies quickly and smoothly. I have 10 pages of images. I load the first page with the initial request and then load the other pages via AJAX calls. I place loading GIFs on each image until that particular image is loaded. It looks all right, but I feel like the images could still load faster. Is there a nice way of speeding up above the fold image loading other than this iterative AJAX call per page thing I'm doing? I've tried to use Compass's sprite sheets, but the sprite size is double that of all the images combined. Even just doing small 8-image sprite sheets are double the size of their encompassing images. So when he does a sprite sheet, it's like 8 times the size.
Increasing the size. But it's increasing the size, but it is reducing the request. So maybe there's a trade-off there.
There might be a trade-off. Is there a way of minimizing the number of requests to the server without skyrocketing the request size?
It seems like, you said I have 10 pages of images. So it is true, Matthew, that not all of your hundreds of images need to be seen the second the page loads. So it sounds like you can load some of them probably right in the HTML and load the other ones via AJAX. So, and then loading the other ones via AJAX is like, how are you doing that? Are you waiting for it to scroll into view? Or did you just start blasting off the requests as soon as window.ready is fired or whatever? Because, you know, why not, I guess. Or do you wait for them to click on a slider thing? I don't know what the UX of your page is. So you may consider waiting or not waiting or whatever, but it seems reasonable that load some, load the rest later. You know, that's kind of the classic way to do it. So I don't know. What's so wrong with that, I guess? it seems like they is it slow? So maybe that's the idea, is you're doing some kind of lazy loading, but you're like being too lazy. It should be like only a little lazy loading, where like you load the first 10, but then kind of right away you start firing off those AJAX calls for more, because you kind of suspect that they're going to be needed anyway.
Yeah. Do you this happened like this week that we were recording this, but do you remember that Reddit React kerfluffle on GitHub where Paul Irish audited Reddit? It was interesting. There, it's basically like too many DOM nodes like appeared and it's slowing down React or something. I'm not picking on that. I what I found was interesting is the Facebook engineer kind of got on there in the thread and was like, usually we just load one screen's worth, like three, let's say, stories, three little feed blocks, and we lazy load the rest after load or after those guys come in. So I think you're doing it right. I think that like you have the right approach. It's kind of your magic on how you're going to do it. You could kind of listen for like when the last one is on load, you know, that image.onload or whatever, you could fire the request for the next set of images. You could trigger the next set of
right,
you know, JSON to come in. I will say, you know, hundreds of images is tough because you start running out of memory. You know, like your iPad is going to bomb out looking at all these images. So you kind of have to, again, you might need to get into some memory management to kind of
You're dumping the old ones. Yeah,
or display nunning or something, just trying to clear up memory.
Interesting, yeah.
But I think like you're doing it right. You're lazy loading, but just it's trying to squeeze performance out of it. I mean, it's interesting because
I think you should be on the first wave of HTTP2. Matthew, you should look into that, because that's kind of like concurrent requests and compressed requests, and you know, no cookies on those additional requests while the connection is still open. That stuff is going to benefit you in a big way. So maybe you can get on that, be on the leading edge of that stuff.
And I would say the sprite sheet thing, don't do it. Because it sounds like these are content images or you know, thumbnail kind of things.
Doesn't seem like the right method, no.
No, and it sounds like a headache. So I wouldn't do that. But I think, you know, yeah, I think you're doing a pretty good job there. You might just, you know, there's a few events like DOM content loaded, window.load. You know, there's a few events you can listen to kind of move yourself up the pipeline. And maybe you rely on the browser image loading a little bit heavier, you know, for at least the second call. Like you do the first page static, the second page AJAX, but maybe it's before DOM content ready. Maybe it's, I don't know. Sorry. I'm just, you don't want to block the thread though. Don't block it. Don't block the, that's the thing people are saying in performance.
Yeah.
Don't block the thread. Don't block the thread. It's like, get out of the paint.
In this one, you're just triggering a request for the image. You don't have to chuck it in the DOM right away. You can just trigger the request so it's cached.
That's true. Yeah, like when you do like new image dot source in JavaScript,
That
fetches like the second you apply a source. So that might be an advantage as well.
All right.
Next, we have an audio question and. Let's see. It's loading, loading, loading. Bill.
Hi, guys. Love the show. I have a brochure-style site for my own business, and I've been working on performance lately. I hooked up with Grunt, started concatenating, moved my JavaScript down and used uglification, and was getting ready to start separating my above-the-fold CSS. It's fun, but the optimization seems to never end. Then I ran into an article about mod page speed. My hosting provider offers it, and Google's info basically says, hey, optimization is tough, so let us take care of it. So, is mod page speed a good idea? Can I be responsibly responsive and use a service like this? What's your learned opinion?
All right, Bill, Bill Burley, good question. Chris, do you have experience with mod PageSpeed?
I think you have more than I do, but it seems like one of those things that nobody's ever said, oh, God, I turned on mod PageSpeed and it was a disaster. It seems like it's always kind of a good move. Although what it does is, I think, a lot of the is some of the stuff that you're already doing, right? Doesn't it kind of auto-compress assets? And I don't know.
Yeah, so mod PageSpeed was Google's kind of like initiative to – it's an Apache or Nginx module that will just make sure compression and deflate is turned on. It makes sure – so that's gzipping, I guess we also call it. It will, you know, kind of concatenate JavaScript. It can actually convert all your JPEGs to WebP, which is kind of a huge thing if it's from Google Chrome, you know. So it does quite a bit. I will tell you my story, and your mileage may vary. I turned it on our server, and I don't know what I'm doing. So I turned it on, and our servers fell over, just like got obliterated. It's pretty memory intensive.
Yeah, it's got to do stuff, you know. Doing stuff.
Yeah, it's basically like, cool, I'll intercept all your requests and calls and run it through my little algorithm and fix your website for you. So it's pretty intensive. So our little server fell over real quick and broke. And that could have been me using a buggy version, or that could have been me, misconfiguring.
Maybe there's some minimum values of what it needs memory wise and stuff that you just didn't have it.
Yeah. And if your hosting provider provides it, I would try it. I mean, turn it on.
Well, because they'll support it, yeah.
Yeah.
Theoretically.
And I think it's, like, pretty common now. And so I would turn it on. I would see what's going on there. Because it's basically just – it's like a best practices for
– But it can – I mean, there's a limit to how much an algorithm can do, right? It can't take all your JavaScript and just shove it in the foot, because that changes the nature of the JavaScript in a sense. Like, there's – you know, like – I don't know. It just does in a way. Like, what if it, you know, it screws up the order in which they load? I mean, maybe you can kind of figure that out still. But I guess is there a perfectly perfect way to have a third party thing concatenate and move your JavaScript around that says this will work in the exact same way it was before, but now it's better? It seems like that's a tall order. Like, you still might have to do some human work there to make sure.
Yeah, I mean, you're gonna have to QA it. See what the robot's doing to make sure it didn't mess up. But what I found was really convincing. I'm going to drop a link in the old show notes here, but there was a post on Perf Planet where this guy says, breaking the page speed barrier with Bootstrap. So he's got a Bootstrap site, and he's like, I'm going to make Bootstrap load in under 1 second. I'm going to be a hero, you know? And like one of the comments, like, but the first comments were from people at Google, and they're like, yeah, so we can do that with all this with PageSpeed. And like, they give you like a one-liner to paste in your Apache config.
Yeah.
And it...
Is it dangerous to think that way? Be like, I don't have to worry about performance because this thing does it for me. Isn't there like, even if you care about performance and use this, isn't that double good?
I think so. I think it's pretty... I think you need both sides of the equation. I think, like, performance-minded, and then with any black box, you know, maybe you, like, just use it, and it's awesome. But then when the black box goes wrong, you don't know what happened. So it's worth, like, in my opinion, doing it by hand before, like, doing it the dumb hard way. Then maybe using a tool that automates that all for you.
Just learn JavaScript first.
Oh, did I just do that to myself? But whoops. So I just think in this example, it's kind of like when you learn about minifying, that really helps in uglifying and concatenating. And maybe that's all obsolete in HTTP 2. That's what people are saying. I have my own opinions currently right this very minute. I learned this week. I think there's quite a bit of best practices bubble up, and these you should be able to automate some of that, but some of the stuff you'll still need to do by hand. That's my final answer.
Okie dokie. Let me tell you, CSS Dev Conf is coming up. That's csdevconf.com. All the sessions at this conference, and it's an in-person conference out in Long Beach, California. They were picked by the community, and double-blind voting was the method they used, meaning that the sessions are what people want to see, not a popularity contest. You'd vote for the sessions based on the content alone, not with any kind of names attached to them, which is pretty cool and led to a nicely diverse thing, too, which is kind of it's interesting how that works, isn't it? You know how these conferences usually work is that there's a couple days of conference stuff and then a workshop, and that's the case here too. So they're encouraging you to check out a post-conference workshop, which is kind of the thing where it's a little bit way more in-depth. Like, you're going to do some actual learning, some actual leveling up of your stuff when you do the workshop kind of thing. So there's one on SAS and visual regressing testing, SMACs, good stuff. Our registration includes breakfast, lunch, and snacks throughout the day. No being hangry at CSS DevConf. They got that covered for you. And after you check out, you'll be able to start making your own schedule, making all the great sessions coming this October. So you can kind of, you know, craft what you want to see and when. And, you know, you know how these things go, too. You vote on the sessions. And so it's multi-track. But then at the end, they repeat the sessions that are the best sessions. So you won't miss the winners, which is pretty cool.
Yep.
You'll always see the best of stuff. All right. Let's do another one.
All right. Next question comes from Kyle Zabo. Hey, guys. I am an email developer, and I had a question about automation. Here's the situation. We send out several emails a week, each email containing anywhere from 25 to 70 links. Gasp. We use a third-party company to provide updated links to allow us to track which link is clicked. Okay, so there's kind of like a tracker involved, right? Let's call it Bitly for everyone's sake.
Okay.
The problem is they provide the links in an Excel document, different from the brief where the original content came from. This forces me to replace each link manually, opening up a large room for error and adding time to each project. Is this something Grunt or Gulp could help with?
Okay, so there's a content person that wrangles up a whole bunch of links for you every week or so, right? Mm-hmm. Then they send it to you in an Excel document. You go to some other service and paste each one in and get a new URL for tracking purposes. Then you take those new URLs and put them in your newsletter and send it out. So that does sound like stuff that computers could help you with. Now, Kyle's asking about Grunt or Gulp. Grunt or Gulp are build tools that don't do anything by themselves, but run plugins that do things, including your own code, if you want to write it that way. So, you know, it's not just like, yeah, Grunt, that'll fix it. You know, you need to find something that Grunt can run that will fix it. So, right. And what might make those shine a little stronger is that there may be multiple steps here. You might need to find or write a plugin or a script of any kind, you know, it could be PHP, whatever, you know, that digs through an Excel document and digs out all those links. That's probably not too particularly hard to write. I don't think the Excel format is impenetrable. You know, there's probably some comma separated lines in there that you parse through and grab the links out of it. Now you have a programmatic collection of links, an array or something, and you could probably write another script which would use the Bitly API or hopefully something like that to get new links for all those links. Now you have another array of all those links and then do something else with them. Automatically place them in their newsletter. I don't know, make a template out of them, something. Maybe there's three scripts you got going on here. Kind of a pull them out of Excel, get new links from those, and then do something with them. And that's where Grunt or Gulp could come in and could be like, hey, Grunt or Gulp, help me. Or all the other new ones. There's a bunch of them. I mean, there's a million of these. And some of them look really awesome, actually. Have you seen Brunch? That one looks kind of sweet. Because it has like the built-in watching and like, and only watch and only do the tasks that are obviously relevant to the things that I've just watched, which seems smart to me. Anyway. Yeah. So anyway, you're in this situation of digging up or writing three scripts-ish to get this done, it seems to me.
I would say Dan Denny was on the show. Was it Dan? Or was it Jason Van Loo? they were doing a lot of email for their business, Envy Labs and Code School, I believe. So they ended up, I think one of, maybe as Envy Labs, basically wrote a Jekyll app, like a Jekyll blog that generates email, which sounds kind of weird, but you could do that. Jekyll has a data folder, like underscore data, and you could just like put CSVs in there and they become data. And
there
then,
you go.
Then you just like write a little like page to loop through and then spit out a full template of all your email. Like you could just, you could use that data to programmatically generate a page, which could be really, really cool. I mean, you're basically, instead of hand coding, you're just like, you're using that data CSV file as a database. So this could be kind of cool and change your workflow. Let me see. Jekyll email is what I'm searching here.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, Gulp could run your Jekyll build.
Totally.
Certainly.
Totally. Yeah. It's called email, E-M-A-Y-L-L. It's Dan Denny / email, email Jekyll, bastardization there. And it's on GitHub. So I can put the link in the show notes. I'm not saying it's like the most foolproof and actually fits your custom situation, but that's where I would maybe start. I'm very interested in like, because writing HTML email by hand is awful. So any point where you can kind of automate is super great. So, and I would, why not just like have this email Jekyll instance spit out really bad HTML for you, and then you copy and you paste that into MailChimp or whatever you're emailing from, and done. Yeah.
It's going to be some work ahead of time, but but you know, that's fun work, and we know it's not fun work is like manually copying and pasting stuff forever. That'll kill you.
Get out of the manual pasting biz.
Even if it takes you like 10 hours to do this, you know, it's still, even if it is like in the net result doesn't save you tons of time, it's still worth it because it's way more fun to work on that than it is anything else. And then the next time this problem comes up, you're way more equipped to solve it. Michael Nepreth writes in, hi, a couple of factors to this question. One, my company is moving to a new platform, so our URL structure is going to be changing once that goes live. Two, we recently purchased a new, shorter, better domain name for our website. We're aware of the fact that you take an SEO hit when you do either of these things. So what do you think? Is it better to make both of these changes at once and take one big hit, or change the main now and update the URL structure later? We're going to be putting in 301 redirects regardless.
Ooh, tough question. Okay, so you're going to have to 301 redirect your URLs, right? But then should you also assume the domain name change hit at the same time?
Seems like a 301 redirect is a 301 redirect. If you're going to be handling 301s in a very, very good way, such that every single URL on your whole site gets moved over to that new domain name and the new URL structure, and it's the same content and it's looking good, I don't even think that you're even going to take much of an SEO hit. In my experiences of changing URLs and changing structure and stuff, as long as I did the 301 stuff okay, it took Google under a week to have it be reflected in search results across the site, and not much of a. If you just ignore it, even then Google will update its stuff and find your new stuff and update itself. But that's more SEO hit territory, I would think.
Yeah.
Like, it's still gonna help you out there. And get the links right in search results, but it's gonna be friendlier towards you, knowing, because you're demonstrating to it that not only can it crawl your site better the second after you make these switches, which is nice because it has redirects to follow, but you're saying none of all the other URLs out there on the web, they all still work too. You know, that's the beauty of the 301 redirect. It's not so much for Google, but it's for all the other existing links out there.
I'm just going to say I don't know about the.
We can't promise you SEO either. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it sort of seems like if you're a new domain, it seems like Google would be like, this is a different business, right? This is a different, I start a whole different tree in my URL machine. So you may hit a duplicate content ding, unless you're 301ing. So would you do it all at the same time, Chris? I would. Do it all at the same time. And yeah. just get, because what's worse is it better for your business to take one big hit or two little hits?
I think if there's a hit at all,
yeah, it's totally recuperable. Recuperable. you can bounce back, is what I'm saying. Flubber. All right. Does that help? Hopefully that helps, Michael. I would do it all at the same time, but we are not liable. Our lawyers are looking at us right now and saying we're not liable for any decisions that you actually make based on our advice. Next question. John Higgins writes in, I was poking around Sarah Sweden's code on her website and saw a bunch of stuff about DNS prefetching. What the what? Link rel DNS-prefetch href www.googleanalytics.com.
So they're just TLDs. It's a link tag in the head, rel equals DNS-prefetch, and then there's an href, and the href is a protocol relative and then a link just to the top-level domain name of a number of things. For example, Google Analytics, ad packs and buy-sell ads, presumably ad servers. I did a view source for a website. There's a whole bunch of these in there. So what on DNS prefetching tags? It's certainly not super common, right?
I think it's a performance boost because the browser can, once it sees the link tag, it's like, cool, I can do something with that. I'm going to go get this, and it's going to show up probably at the bottom of the page. But I've already negotiated like a handshake. Like, I don't have to hit my DNS servers when I go to get that JavaScript. So I think it can do that asynchronously. It tries to make an asynchronous.
It's not blocking the thread, man.
Not blocking the thread. Get out of the thread, out of the paint. Don't block the paint.
But it's doing what could be one of the slowest parts of a... So if you look at like the network timeline for any given request, there's all these different parts, right? There's the prefetch, presumably, right at the beginning. And then there's, you know, some kind of like cookie transfer and back and forth handshaking and HTTPS negotiation. And there's like different parts of this. Oftentimes the actual sending of the data is the longest part, but you never know. Like DNS is highly variable, I think. And sometimes it's really, really super fast. Like your computer has already seen that domain name recently, so it's kind of cached. And sometimes it's like, I've never seen this URL ever. And it's not an IP, so I need to like figure out what that name means and go get like, you know, do some network handshaking or whatever. Apparently, I think this is a Chrome thing that's not standardized. It may be. I'm not actually sure. But when you Google it, most of the information about it is on Chrome pages. I don't know what supports it. I don't know what the case is. But I think it's exactly like Dave explained.
It looks like Firefox 3.5, and that was maybe the first browser shipped in. Chrome, all Chrome. Maybe it's all Chrome. Safari 5, Opera is now Blink.
Wow.
And IE9. So this is weird. I mean, not weird, but like I'm sure it's a great thing to do. Is it?
I mean, I haven't seen it. It doesn't seem to be part of the normal regiment of performance. Obvious do this stuff. It doesn't hang out with the like optimize your images, concatenate requests. You know, I see less about this. Does it belong in that party or are there some gotchas? I guess I just don't know and they probably should be careful about.
I wonder what it works out on mobile too, because you're making an extra request and the request is the expensive part, right? Even if it's an async, it's like,
but it's like it's only a part of a request, you know. I don't think we can link it into just saying it's a request.
Yeah, it's, I guess, like, it's like a,
all right, because you're not paying the cookie price and you're not paying the HTTPS price here. You're just doing the first part of the request, which is figure out, you know,
who that website.
Yeah.
If you use DNS prefetching or something, and you are seeing like massive speed boosts or not massive speed boosts, Please
leave tell us about it.
Yeah,
I suspect it's a good idea.
It seems like it would be, but I think it's also that it's kind of a mystery thing. It's like no one ever is like, oh, you know what? You like you optimize your images, but you forgot DNS prefetching, dude. You know, that doesn't happen to me in my life. So maybe it's not.
Maybe your own CDN would be a particularly good one too. Maybe this is the old debate where like, don't bother for Google Analytics. Every site has that. But if it's a weird domain, you kind of know that your users probably haven't hit that one before.
Yeah, maybe it's. And I'll try it. I'll try it on a day trip because we're using an old S3 for our images. Maybe that'll give us a little jump. So I'll try it. I'll see what happens. And then yeah. So all right.
Do it. Brand new sponsor for us, Braintree. Braintree is a super awesome payments provider API out there on the web, kind of widely beloved. It's one of those sites that everybody kind of applauds, I feel like, and probably rightfully so. I think a couple of years ago-ish, I can't remember exactly when it happened, but they were bought by PayPal. No surprise. Congratulations, because they're kind of awesome. And they make, for example, working with PayPal even easier. So you set up your APIs, all your payment stuff for your application to use the Braintree APIs, and then you kind of then your site can take multiple kinds of payments like PayPal, for example. So you're working with Braintree APIs, but collecting money through PayPal and Bitcoin and Venmo and Apple Pay and Android Pay and, you know, like prepaid cards and stuff. All that happens through one, just the Braintree API. You work with it by using their version.0 SDK, one small snippet of code, and you're all set up in less than 10 minutes. The easiest way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Quick, knowledgeable developer support. If you have any questions, all that stuff. Just one integration. Learn more. Go to the URL braintreepayments.com/shoptalk and sign up. And the first $50,000 that you collect will be transaction fee free, which is
Dude,
pretty sweet.
What?
Thanks for
congratulations. We are all rich. Thanks, Braintree. I'm going to buy a car. Thank you. That's great. All right, I'm very excited about this sponsor. I'm like looking at this Apple Pay documentation. You just dump some stuff in there, and then boom, bang, boom, paying with Apple.
I mean, isn't it fairly obvious that you want your web app to accept money in any way anybody wants to pay you in?
Yes.
If some nerds want to pay you in Bitcoin, take it, because it just gets instantly converted into U.S. dollars. It's not like you have to start having Bitcoin vaults and stuff now too. It doesn't work like that. They just pay in that, and it gets converted, and you have it. Do you want them to use their Apple Pay account because it's already set up and their credit card's in there and people trust it and it's applauded for its security? Heck yeah. Pay me any way you want to.
Yeah.
And that's what Braintree makes possible with one API instead of a whole bunch of different ones.
Mm, wonderful. All right. That deserves this. That deserves this. Okay. All right. Marcel writes in, I've been messing around with critical path CSS and getting content to my users as fast as possible, which seems to mean accepting fout and other visual jankiness before all the style scripts and images have loaded. It got me wondering, do I now have to choose between a site that loads super fast and a site that loads with fancy transitions and animations? Surely optimizing the critical path is all about removing anything that delays the arrival of content on the page. If the two are mutually exclusive, would this choice then be dictated by the type of content on the page? Example, a long-form news article versus a flashy advertising one page. Marcel's kind of asking, with critical path and trying to render as quickly as possible, are we sacrificing experience and fancy transitions and animations? Chris, what are your thoughts?
It seems like because you go with critical path CSS, that's one of the is there an official term for this thing yet? We're talking about the thing where you put a style block in the head that's only a small part of the CSS from your overall style sheet. The idea being that it comes across in the first packet and your browser has CSS to, and then it's like the time to first paint is way down or something. That's the thing that we're talking about here. Marcel is saying, does that mean that there's going to be fout for sure? Fout meaning flash of unstyled, I guess it would be content of EFOUC in this case, right? Does it mean that when that final CSS does load, that now there's more of it and it's going to affect more of the page, so it's going to go and like change visual and it's going to be visually janky? When that happens, is that like guaranteed that you're going to see EFOUC when you use it? Head CSS? I don't know that that's necessarily true.
I think kind of. I think that's a pretty common thing. Like, if you go to my blog, like, there'll be a little, like, pop when the font kind of negotiates and comes in.
But the deal is, if that font was slower, it wouldn't. There'd still be content there. So yeah, it's a little pop, but it's, like, mad fast.
Yeah, if the JavaScript died along transit, died in transit, or the font just lingered or something. In theory, I'm protected.
Like, or even if it's just slow, you're just on a real slow connection.
The user should be able to read my site, like scroll through and read my site without suffering. That's kind of my hope. When I build out my website.
And the trade-off, much like Fout, that we like now, as we talked with Tim Brown recently on, is that you like that. Like, it is a little janky, but just the fact that it's for sure going to be there and it's for sure real fast and it's, like, you know, kind of competitive with native apps kind of thing going on is worth it.
I mean, if you're worried about animations and stuff, maybe save your animations for later in the page, like on page scroll or something like that. I worry with all these animations and stuff, and how many loaders do you see when you open websites these days? You know, everyone's trying to provide this beautiful immersive experience, and it's like, users don't care. They like just want to visit your website like as quickly as possible. They're busy. Like, don't impede that. And so that's kind of like back in the days with Flash, we used to just spin up little animations like waiting. If you wait 10 minutes, it's going to be worth it because I loaded sound. And so you should wait. I think that's the rudest thing you could do to somebody.
You know, for years and years, I've used this technique almost every time when I do kind of bigger animation-y stuff, which is I namespace all of every major animation with page loaded or animations ready or something, and that way you just do basically like window dot onload or whatever, add to class HTML element, you know, page loaded or animations ready or whatever you want to call it, and then you only apply those animations in the case that parent element has that class on it. Otherwise, I don't know, like, if you might have, like, you know, for example, imagine the CodePen editor, and it has, for a while, actually recently removed this for performance reasons and cross-browser compatibility reasons, but used to be able, like, when you closed the HTML editor, it would like animate its way closed. So it's like this major box, this major like page layout box on the screen that has a transition applied to it. So when the width changes, it animates. But that was actually like loading the way that it would like load in kind of animated-y looking. And it was like extra weird janky. Like, it would know, as the page is laying out and doing its stuff, something would shift around or change and it would transition to that new size. It was like totally awkward. So I started doing a thing where I was like, okay, this box does have a transition on it, but only after the page is entirely completely loaded. I don't know if that's exactly relevant to this discussion, but just a little tip there.
No, just how you're animating and stuff. I think the, like, companies, like, client services or even product companies that figure out how to do this well, how to do critical but also yet like very rich and almost like the user doesn't even see the FOUC. Like, I feel like shops that get this and understand this and are able to do this seamlessly, that's a huge differentiator. I feel like that's going to be like a massive like separator between good shop and bad shop is people who can do this and then do it really well. So that's my personal opinion. I am a tech pundit. So yes, bearish on critical path here. So good luck. Next question. Let's see, Wes. Vakuba. Sorry, Wes. just wrote in. Do you want to read it, Chris? You got it?
I can. Wes says he recently co-presented a talk on front-end architecture at a good-sized event. From the comments, not many, but you know, considering the size of the audience, people wanted much more direct answers. One comment pointed out that what it boiled down to was, it depends on the project, and seemed frustrated by that as an answer. The talk was about what the available options are and what the guidelines are, what we choose from. I feel like that, well, it depends, is a recurring theme of lots of the answers that you get, presumably us on Chop Doc Show, because that's the nature of the beast. Given that, and that you guys also have a lot of speaking experience, I'm curious what you think. Is that kind of a nuanced topic? Is this kind of talk, when, again, his talk was about front-end architecture, was this kind of nuanced topic not good for talks at events? Is the feedback from the audience inevitable, or should I keep submitting talks until a cane pulls me off stage? So Wes's talk was about front-end architecture, and he said, well, here's a way to do it, here's another way to do it, here's what this person says, here's what another philosophy on it, and people at the end of it said, come on, give me an answer.
This is tough. I mean, that's called consulting, isn't it? Like, which one should I do for my website? So that's where your expertise would come in, because you'd probably want to do some discovery and figure out what they're trying to achieve and what even the internal talents are. Do they have in-house development, or do they just farm everything out to contractors overseas or something? I obviously, let's do the talking part, because that's easy. Keep talking and always try to get feedback about your from trusted friends and people. Maybe do the talk for your coworkers. Laura Hogan has a good set of posts on all of this, on how to get feedback and give feedback from your coworkers. So I would do that. But what do you do when your answer to a presentation is, it depends? That's sort of tough, huh? Maybe you could advocate for one type of development. I personally advocate for very modular web design, modular front-end architecture, responsive deliverables is a post I wrote, so people sort of expect me to talk about that. So maybe that's where you start, is you say, there are these things, here's the one I would advocate for in most of my work.
It is tough, right? Because of course it depends is a good answer, and it's just the truth in a lot of cases. But you're right in that sometimes just presenting one answer ends up being more useful. I don't know if that's what you were saying necessarily, but imagine the early days of responsive web design. People would be giving talks that said, well, here's adaptive design, here's responsive design, here's static design, here's m.sites, and they would have this, and to them it seemed nuanced and stuff, and that's changed over time, and now it's kind of basically just like do responsive web design, right? It's changed the face of that in a way. So people just, you know, now we're a little bit more comfortable just giving that as an answer. Here's another one. I was, sometimes a lot of this like build tool stuff is a little bit just like, it depends. Do you use Broccolini or Brunch or Gulp, or which one do you want to use? That's nuanced. Well, they run different things, and the plugin, the community's different for them, and the plugins available for them are different. So I don't know. Just think about it. Do some discovery. Pick the one that's right for you. Yeah, but, you know, sometimes it can be nice to just give somebody something like, here's, and I guarantee you they want that, just as you experienced. They want just an answer. It happened to me in a recent project. I was just like, I don't know, I'm not going to even set up a bunch of fancy build tools because I don't need them. I'm only doing like two things here, and it just doesn't matter. But it was ended up working with another company on the thing, and they're just like, you know what, we're just gonna blast in our entire set of Gulp. They have a Gulp based build tool system, and it just has a 50 tasks in it. It just has everything in there. And this little website, I just didn't need any of it at first. I was just like, ugh. Not like, can you just do this now? Because now I'm just like, I don't know where to start. This is your system. And I think they like it because they keep it consistent across all their projects. So when you jump from project to project, a lot of these gulp tasks are kind of the same. So they just know they're named the same. The folder structure is largely the same and stuff like that. It's like, I kind of get it. But in this case, I was just kind of told what to use, you know, or just, it was just pressed upon me, like, use this. And in the end, it took me like a day. And I was like, all right, I kind of like that. That was pretty good.
Mm. So yeah. Your first reaction to a proposed solution was, nah, or like, what is this? But then as it, you learned it. Like,
I had a system. My system was working fine. It was really simple.
Yeah, because I guess if you're in Wes's situation and you're like, here's you know, any preprocessor, SAS, less or stylus, whatever, you know, like that's not as cool as somebody getting up here like, you know, there's SAS, less and stylus, and I'm going to talk to you about SAS because this is way more interesting to me. I've chosen SAS for X, Y, and Z, kind of like what you did in your blog post on why you chose SAS, Chris. But I think that's kind of how you have to approach things, is kind of like have an opinion, maybe, or propose everything, but have an opinion about something. I'm doing a talk right now for...
Propose everything, but have an opinion. That's pretty good,
Dave. Is that good? Is that the most profound thing I've ever said on the show?
Maybe.
So I'm doing a talk on prototypes for an Event Apart and in a few other conferences this year. CSS DevConf, maybe, or that might be a new talk. I don't know.
By the way, final keynote of the whole thing. Did you know that?
Oh, really? Whoa. No. Ruh-roh. So what I do is I present a bunch of prototyping tools and even tools I kind of don't use, but I know they're out there. I know people use them. And then I make a point in my talk, it's like in one of the little notes on the slide, is like, but what I'm going to advocate for is code prototypes, because I feel very strongly that getting your idea into code as quickly as possible can have amazing ramifications for everybody. So that's part of my talk. And so I present kind of everything really quickly, kind of highlight, as quick as possible. And then I talk kind of about the thing I am kind of gung-ho about. So that would be something I would recommend for your just tweaking your talk. But again, we haven't seen it. We don't know. And front-end architecture can be as big as, like, what preprocessor do you use to, like, what, what stack, are you deploying to S3, Amazon, blah. So that's a very wide net. So maybe it's like, can I just do the profound thing? Present everything, have an opinion about something, one thing?
Okay. Maybe that should be your talk.
Yeah. The generalist mantra. All right, next question.
I think we already did that one. Did I put it in there twice on accident? Maybe.
Yep.
We can finish out with this one, though. Abbas Monfared writes in. Very question near to Dave's heart, perhaps. Should I get a Mac? I've been a Windows user for 12 years now, and I just feel more comfortable using Windows. But I see all developers are using Macs. Screencasts are on Mac. A lot of the new apps are Mac only. Should I just give up and switch to OS X? I'm sure we have listeners that this resonates with, that we know from our statistics of people that visit the site, that there's plenty of you Windows people out there. But I do feel you. It does seem like a lot of people talk, and I'm the most guilty person of all time in this regard. And we've talked about trying to change that on this show a little bit, right?
Yep. And if all goes well and the UPS guy shows up today, I will be on Windows. So take a deep breath. There are reasons like you may want a Mac. Like I think we've said in the past, should I get a Mac because all my designers are giving me Sketch files, and Sketch doesn't have a Windows app. That may be a situation where it makes business sense to do that. And just so you have a tool to process a tool, or have a friend with a Mac who can spit out assets for you. But man, I like, I think the web needs to be universal, and that's why part of the reason I'm doing the hashtag Dave Goes Windows thing is because that's the greatest strength of the web, is that it should work everywhere. There are tools and frameworks that don't work everywhere, and that could bite me, like Ruby and Node. I apparently have trouble on Windows at times, but I'm going to learn the ins and outs of how that works. So it's not such a scary thing, and so that we can kind of be on different platforms. I mean, you know, there are Windows PCs that cost as much as Macs, but like in general, like Macs are like 3-5x more expensive than Windows PCs and tablets and or laptops. So it's kind of makes you wonder, like should, you know, how accessible is Mac only monoculture for web development? It just doesn't seem right to me. You know, and Abbas, I don't know where you live, but like, you know, people in other countries, you know, they're mostly, you know, Windows countries. You know, there's a lot of countries that are still very dominant Windows. So don't, you know, I mean, that may be an advantage in your market or your, you know, or your niche of business. You know, a lot of business still do PowerPoint, and they want, you know, they want to pull up the website on their PowerPoints. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons I would maybe stick. Although you're probably like me, getting tired of all the tutorials and everything being Mac centric. You know, just brew install your problem and it's fixed. You know,
especially I think it's starting to come to a fever pitch because of this, and we covered this on the Andy Budd show. I think that kind of, you know, Apple is Safari, and nobody's particularly happy with Safari these days, I feel like. And it's, you know, it's the same company. So, you know, not that they're tied at the hip, you know, you can enjoy one company's hardware and not like their software and stuff. It just seems a little weird that it's like all of us web people are using this company that's not exactly been as friendly as they could be in the, yeah, in that world. I don't know where I'm going
well,
with
I
that,
think
but
they're,
I have
they're
another
changing
point
that. But I just read some tweets that they're going to start going to conferences and stuff and kind of opening
really?
Up. Yeah.
Oh, we'll have to cover this in a upcoming show.
Yeah. But there's, you know, I think like from a culture standpoint, well, it is great hardware. Let's just say that Apple has some of the best hardware, and you pay for that. Like you pay very much monies for this Retina Max and stuff. But it's not the only way to access the web. And I feel like we damage ourselves. You know, we only see the web in current iPhone and iPad and Retina iMac screen sizes. We don't see it as a myriad of devices. And so that's kind of what we're trying to inject here in the Shop Talk show, just going Windows.
Dave's going to thank bless you, Dave.
Well, I'm taking a bullet for the team, and we should say that, like, only hardware, no real, you know, money's changing hands here. So this is an honest attempt to see what it's like.
Yeah. So this is our pivot in Dave Goes Windows.
I'm going to blog and stuff about the experience. So, and you know, it'll make, you know, there'll be things here. So we'll keep tabs on how it's all going. So, kind of fun experiment, but yeah, unless you like in your heart of hearts buy whatever hardware you want, but I would, you know, if you like Windows, use Windows. That would be my advice. Chris, what's your final?
Well, yeah, I do have one kind of final point to make, and that it seems like a lot is made of this, in that let's talk about it kind of from a price perspective a little bit. Computers aren't particularly cheap, but they're also, in the grand scheme of things in your business and being at the absolute number one most important primary tool to operate your life and business, period, is fairly cheap. It's not even near the price of a car that a lot of people need to operate their business. It's not anywhere near the price of, you know, office space and stuff like that. I'm just looking at a new MacBook Pro, the highest end edition, 2.9 gigahertz processor, 512 gigabyte flash storage. You know, that's the nicest laptop they sell, is $1,799. So it's like, you know, it's expensive. It's nice. It's this amazing machine. You know, you can, I'm sure you can buy beefed up pretty baller Windows machines that would probably be in the neighborhood of the same amount of money.
But it in the grand scheme of things, is the price of an old Dodge Caravan. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah,
right. And true. It's kind of like, this is your business. This is the tool. You could have both. You could have three of each. It seems like, I know that seems, I know I'm not trying to be like this privileged white boy talk on the show about, just throw money around. It doesn't matter. But I feel like that's worth talking about a little bit, is that this is it's actually fairly cheap instrument for to be the primary home of your business. And I just think that it's like, you should have what you need. Be like, I can't possibly afford an Apple machine. Then you're not really in the business of being a computer person. If a $1,000 or $2,000 thing is just completely outside of the realm of operating costs for your business, it's not really a business.
That, well,
feel free to tweet me that I'm a jerk. But.
Yeah, hashtag geez, Chris. That's a totally fair point. And I could also segue into the job.
I don't want to hear it. Macs are expensive. I won't hear it. Goodbye.
I just feel like if we're developing websites only on high-end hardware, we only think about consequences on high-end hardware. But
that's true. That's a different conversation in a sense. But yeah.
Which is why you should probably have a phone you use, and then like a little $50 phone that you test websites on. I mean, that's another thing too. Like, it's not just computers. It's like, should I have an Android tablet in my like drawer, you know, and like, it's expensive to collect all these Pokemons, these devices, but you probably should if you're going to be taking web development seriously. So you should probably have some amount of device lab, you know. So I don't know. That's hopefully that helps, boss. But I will be going Windows, and that will hopefully we'll see how hard it is, and you know, what are the app workarounds and stuff like that. So that's kind of exciting to think about. So, and frightening, because I've been a Mac user for 12 years. So all I know, like, in my adult life is Mac. So anyway, let's wrap this up, Chris. Wow. This has been a Rapid Fire episode. If you would do us a favor, rate this up in your podcatcher of choice, 5 stars or whatever. That's just that easy. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And if you hate your job, go get a new one and make money to buy devices over at shoptalkshow.com/jobs. Chris, you got anything else before we go? We're kind of entering season 4 or 5 here.
Something like that. So. Yeah, we'll have a few more guests, a few more rapid fires, I think. But yeah, we will be, by the time you hear this one, we'll be kind of entering some new territory. Not like a hugely big deal. I think the idea is that we're just going to try some different formats just for fun. Maybe we'll do a panel. Maybe we'll do like a straight ahead interview. Maybe we'll do, you know, maybe we'll pick a book and read it and talk about it. We'll just try some stuff just to switch it up, have some more fun. So if you have some ideas of things you'd like to hear us do, we'll probably always do some kind of Q&A stuff or like have that be our base format, but we're just going to have some fun. Just to make sure that you all that have been listening for, you know, by the end of the year, we'll be pretty close to 200 episodes, are bored to tears.
Yeah. Y'all who have been in for the long haul, we'll make sure we kind of keep it interesting. So, awesome. Well, okay. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and goodbye. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
ChopDocShow.com.